to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. And joining us today is Dr. Norman Doidge. Dr. Doidge is the author of The Brain That Changes Itself, and the new book is The Brain's Way of Healing. Doctor is a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, researcher, author, essayist, and poet, and he's on the faculty at the University of Toronto's Department of Psychiatry and research faculty at Columbia University's Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research in New York. He is also the author of New York Times bestsellers, as I mentioned, The Brain That Changes Itself, and the new one, The Brain's Way of Healing. Doctor, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
It's interesting, when we talk about the brain, a lot of people, you know, we've heard about, don't you have a brain? What's wrong with you? And, of course, the Wizard of Oz, the Scarecrow, wanted a brain. So the brain has always been a sort of a, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of complicated topic for a lot of people, saying that, you know, the brain's way of working is very mysterious. And for like 150 years or so, nothing was really done. And all of a sudden, as you mentioned in your book, with neuroplasticity, things have changed. So tell us a little bit about how did that come about as far as people, you know, putting the brain kind of at arm's length away and all of a sudden deciding, oh, look what we found.
Well, I would put it this way. There has been a lot of research in the last 150 years, but the model we had of the brain was that it was like a machine with parts, and each part performed a single mental function in a single location in the brain. And if that part was damaged, as is the case with machines, nothing could be done because machines don't grow new parts. This machine model was very, very strong. I mean, we still speak of, people write books like The Machinery of the Brain, and we talk about the circuits of the brain as though it's an electrical machine. Now, for 100 years, that's been the master analogy, that it's an electrical machine or it's like a computer. Now, there are electrical things about the brain, that's for sure. But part of the problem was that the view we had of it as an electrical machine declared that its circuits were hardwired, meaning that they were genetically predetermined, and once they were formed and finalized in childhood, there was nothing you could do to change it. And if you had a learning disability or a stroke or Parkinson's or some kind of brain damage, you were really stuck with that because it was hardwired. And we now discover that the brain actually is frequently changing its wiring. And that's what neuroplasticity is about. Neuro is the neurons in the brain. Plastic means changeable, adaptable, and modifiable. And we can actually change brain structure through what we do in our everyday lives and through mental activity. So when we learn something, connections between neurons in the circuits change. And what my book is about is applying that to help deal with a lot of conditions that folks were told you couldn't do very much with. Certain kinds of traumatic brain injuries that occur, learning disorders, autism, chronic pain. We can enhance treatments for MS and Parkinson's. We can even use some neuroplastic treatments to lower the risk of dementia in a lot of people.
The thing that interested me the most, and I guess because I suffer from chronic pain, is the part on chronic pain that you had at the beginning of your book. And would you mind explaining to our listeners what you mean about using neuroplastic therapy for chronic pain sufferers?
Sure. So let me describe three kinds of pain. First, there's acute pain. You injure your limb, and if you move it around, your brain produces a pain signal that's very, very powerful and says, don't move that limb. It'll hurt it more. Then, because the brain is plastic, if you, let's say, pinch a nerve in your spine and you keep pinching it over and over and over again, the brain actually gets better at processing pain, and you can become hypersensitive. And if it keeps it up, you actually get a chronic pain syndrome that lasts much longer than even an acute twinge of pain and actually can spread through the body. That has to be distinguished from people who have lots and lots of acute pain over time. So chronic pain, acute pain is a problem with the limb. chronic pain is a problem with the limb and the pain system itself, and it's really about plasticity gone wild. Plasticity can be a blessing if you want to, I don't know, study music and become more refined at listening to music, but it's a curse if you're constantly in pain. Now, a pain physician named Michael Moskowitz, who himself developed a chronic pain syndrome, realized that the brain is plastic, and he developed a treatment for chronic pain. It was a totally mental treatment. So he was in a water skiing accident. He hurt his neck. A nerve got pinched. And over time, it went from acute pain to chronic pain. And it went from one side of his neck to the other, to his head, to his shoulders and his back. And he was disabled, 8 out of 10 pain. As a pain physician, he knew a couple of things that are very interesting. There's not one pain center in the brain. In fact, there are about a dozen major pain centers in the brain. And all of them pretty much are dual-purpose centers. What I mean by that is they don't just process pain, they do something else as well. So you may have noticed when you're in chronic pain, you can be irritable and you're emotionally easily dysregulated. And that's because one of the areas that processes pain also processes emotion. And some areas process pain and imagery and pain and attention. It's hard to do higher mental imagery work if you're in pain. When you're in chronic pain, the amount of the brain map that's devoted to processing pain increases about 20%. It gets hijacked for pain. So what Moskowitz did was he said, since there are two brain maps that are involving imagery and pain, whenever I'm in pain, I am going to actually force myself to use imagery. And what he chose, the imagery he chose is irrelevant as long as he was using imagery. I'll tell you what he chose in a second. But what was happening is every time, relentlessly, he had pain, he would just force himself to visualize to try to stop the brain from being hijacked from chronic pain. Now, what he chose was this. He chose three brain scans, real brain scans, the brain not in pain, none of the pain centers lit up, the brain in acute pain where there were pinpricks in about a dozen centers, and the brain in chronic pain where those pinpricks grow into supernovas. And he simply imagined turning a switch in the brain to turn it down, because we know that the brain has switches that turn off pain. When Ronald Reagan was shot, he was not in pain. He joked, I'd been shot many times in the movies, and I always thought it hurt, so I acted like it hurt. But when I was really shot, I discovered it doesn't always hurt. The brain can turn off pain in acute situations. Anyway, Moskowitz did this relentlessly. After several weeks, he just had moments when he went free of pain. And I want to emphasize, he had been tried on all known medications. He was still on medication. They weren't working. And he tried all the complementary treatments. At the end of several months, he had substantial pain-free periods. Again, every time he had a twinge of pain, he went into this complex visualization. By the end of the year, he was off all pain meds, and he was completely pain-free. And now he uses that with patients. And I describe his work in detail, and it's more subtle than I've described. And he uses other ways to flood the brain to deal with pain, as well as mental imagery. But chronic pain is plasticity gone wild in the brain, and you can use neuroplastic principles, if you understand them, to wind it back.
We are visiting with Dr. Norman Deutsch. Dr. Deutsch is the author of the best-selling, New York Times best-selling book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and the new book is The Brain's Way of Healing. Following up on the chronic pain that Dr. Moskowitz was working on, there's a story in there about a nurse that got hurt helping lifting a patient, and she was in chronic pain for almost a decade, I think, and then she tried the neuroplastic therapy, and it did marvels for her.
Yeah, that's Jan Sandin. Very similar to the Moskowitz experience. She had a severely damaged back. It was so damaged that actually surgeons said, we actually don't think we can operate on it. And she was disabled for years, groggy on medication, and so on. And she did this, and she had a similar recovery. I've seen Jan three times because I've followed her because she's in San Francisco. She's doing great. If you saw an x-ray of her back, it's god-awful. It's still damaged, but the point is the brain is just turning off the pain signal. So some of Moskowitz's patients are like Jan. They basically completely go off all medication. Others, you know, have very, very severe problems, and what they've been able to do is radically lower the medication so that they don't have any side effects of mental fog and so on. But they're still working on it. So there's a variety of outcomes, but the delightful thing is this is something you can do anywhere, anytime. Moskowitz had at times used hypnosis, and hypnosis can be extraordinary for certain pain things, but, you know, patients have to learn to hypnotize themselves. It takes time to go into a trance and so on. And what he liked about this is you could apply it anytime, anywhere. And he's gone on to make some other really important discoveries about neuroplasticity and pain.
And Doctor, well, I'm glad you brought up hypnosis because some of our listeners might wonder, well, is neuroplastic therapy similar to hypnosis?
Actually, it's not. I mean, the only thing that's important to keep in mind is the hypnotists discovered that there are all these switches. They thought they were in the mind, but now we see they're mind and brain switches. And great hypnotists are able to help people turn off pain. But you have to get into a special altered mental state. The thing about this particular approach, and I don't want them to go head-to-head. I think hypnosis was an incredible discovery that's underutilized. But neuroplastic approaches, you are building up new brain structures systematically over time, and you can be in a normal conscious state to do that. It's just not a hypnotic trance. I'm not knocking hypnosis. I've trained in hypnosis, but this is just different. And it's not a placebo effect either, because the placebo effect tends to wane over time. But using this mental training technique, you actually get better and better at it over time.
When you're talking about getting better and better, you know, Dr. Moskowitz, of course, he studied that. He learned about that. He saw, you know, mapping of the brain. The ordinary person sitting at home listening who is suffering from chronic pain or Parkinson's or something else like that, they would ask you, I guess, so how do I go about learning this? And does my physician know about this? And most importantly, does insurance cover this? Because sometimes the insurance are dictating how we're treated.
There are a whole bunch of questions there.
Yes, yes.
I write about cutting-edge things. The chances are your physician doesn't know about this. Your physician knows a lot, but when the whole point about writing about cutting-edge things is on the frontier is that they're new things. That I write about, and insurance is usually the last to cover new things. You know, in general, insurance likes to cover things like medication where your physician can see you very quickly, ask you, do you have any side effects, what are they, raise it, lower it, I'm talking about for pain, and send you on your way and let the medication do the work. Here, the physician has to train the patient to do it, but you know, it's important not to be penny-wise, pound-foolish. I mean, the thing about this particular technique, and we were just talking about pain, there's stuff, different treatments for autism, learning disorders, Parkinson's, MS in the book. They're all different. But this one in particular, the patient can do on his or her own much of the time. So it doesn't matter if insurance covers it or not. It's not going on mostly in the doctor's office. Jan Sandin didn't have a lot of appointments with Dr. Moskowitz to train to do this, and he's got a workbook. But first of all, you got to see if it sounds right for you. And for that, I suggest, you know, you read over the chapter. The technique is laid out there. I've had people read the chapter and write me and said that reading the chapter was enough to get them started on it with the main points. Or contact Dr. Moskowitz and look up his workbook. You can get the spelling of his name and so on from my book.
We are visiting with Dr. Norman Deutsch, and he is the author of the best-selling, New York Times best-selling book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and the new one is The Brain's Way of Healing. I was going to ask you about, if you're familiar with Dr. John Sarno's books, is that kind of something about, like, imagery or getting it all in your mind?
Dr. Sarno is a really important pioneer in mind-body medicine. I think he was writing before neuroplasticity had become as widely known as it is now. There were similarities, but you know, I just want to say the essence of the brain's way of healing, we've talked about that chapter, but the essence of my book actually deals a lot with the use of the senses to deal with serious neurological conditions. Basically, you know, the brain fires patterns of electrical energy, and because the brain is plastic, if you could speak to the brain in a way to modify those patterns of electrical energy, you can change brain structure and function. And so the ways that things like autism, learning disorders, Parkinson's and MS are helped is and stroke is actually through stimulating the brain through the senses. You know, think about it. Your ear converts sound energy into electrical energy. That's how it works, and it converts the patterns in the sound energy in music and the human voice and language into patterns of electrical energy. The eye converts patterns in the visual field into electrical patterns. And what these interventions do is we develop a way of talking to the brain in its own electrical language. So I'll just give you an example, for instance, from something extreme that parents are told every day is fundamentally genetic and there's nothing you can do about it, which is autism. Autistic kids are often very hypersensitive to sounds. The sound they hear hurt them. They often cover their ears. They start to fall away from having personal relations if they have what's called an autistic regression. They don't make eye contact with parents. They have a lot of temper tantrums. They're very, very upset. I describe a sound-based intervention which has helped a lot of autistic children neuroplastically. So the reason that they have these sound sensitivities is the ear normally has a kind of auditory zoom in it. You know, you walk into a party, it's like all noise, and then you can hone in on particular conversations. But autistic children can't. And actually, they hear very disturbing low frequencies. This, you know, when you go to Jaws and the shark comes on and it's boom, 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 that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing they hear. And that's why low machines are so distressing to them. And it puts them into a fight-or-flight reaction. And I've seen kids with autism who were supposed to be institutionalized have music and voices that are modified to train up that auditory zoom. And they lose their hearing sensitivities. Their language starts to work, but most importantly, they start to get socially engaged. They're no longer in constant fight or flight. One boy, after a couple of days of that treatment, hugged his father for the first time. That boy went on to graduate high school. A guy, he could just say do, 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 and he got an A in English. And, you know, he's on track to go to university, and he has friendships. And most importantly, his parents said, you know what? We have a relationship with him now. So that's wonderful. And other kinds of interventions have been helpful for MS and Parkinson's, and I've got 5 interventions for traumatic brain injury, all non-invasive, coming in through the senses. And that's great because some people who don't get better from traumatic brain injury are told that nothing will ever get them better.
We are visiting with Dr. Norman Deutsch. Dr. Deutsch is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and the new book is called The Brain's Way of Healing. Doctor, in your book, you also mentioned a certain device that can reset the brain. It's the portable neuromodulation stimulator. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So what it does is the following. It's been especially helpful in I've seen it helpful in stroke, in Parkinson's, and MS, and traumatic brain injury. Basically, you're on your tongue. There are about 15,000 pathways leading right into the brain. There are nerves on the tongue that go right into the brain stem. It's only an inch and a half in front of the back of your brain. And so when the brain is damaged, often the cells aren't all dead. Some of them are just firing irregular signals. And in all these illnesses that I just described, there's a noisy brain firing irregular signals. And you put this device on your tongue, and it has the, you know, the gentlest electrical firing, just enough to turn on the touch receptors to talk to them, to send signals, you know, about an inch and a half into the brainstem and reset it. And so a person can come in, you know, a man came in with MS. He'd completely lost his voice. By the end of the week, his voice is back. He came in on a cane. By the end of the week, he didn't need his cane. His brain was reset. His noisy brain was quieted. He wasn't cured of MS, but what happened is his noisy brain was quieted so it could function much, much better. And there was no change in medication there. So he got function back. The same thing happens with Parkinson's and traumatic brain injury. If the person's had a one-time, MS is an inflammatory disease that's on, tends to be ongoing, and although a few people have actually helped themselves with dietary changes in MS, I must say, I mean, I've met people like that. But assuming they haven't been able to help themselves with those things, you have to just keep resetting the brain. But in cases like a stroke, which is a one-time event, I described the Mary Gaines, who had a stroke. She had conventional rehab at a very outstanding institution, but she still could barely speak and had lots of sound sensitivities. She used this device, the PoNS, and would use it each day and practice speaking simultaneously. And now she no longer needs the PoNS, and she speaks well. So there's a case where you don't have to keep using it for the rest of your life, because if you practice with it long enough and you've had a one-time brain event, you can build a new circuit, and then once the circuit's there, you just use it every day.
Doctor, would the PoNS unit be similar to perhaps a TENS unit that somebody uses for back pain or something like that?
Well, it's similar in the sense that it's electric. Uh-huh. But, I mean, the team in Madison, Wisconsin that's developed this, just spent, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of hours to find the exact frequency to use to speak to the brain to allow it to reset. So, I mean, the principle that we are talking to the brain with an electrical language is similar, but it's all in the fine details. The lab is called the Tactile and Communication Lab in Madison, Wisconsin at the university there. And, I think they're the world experts in learning how to use electricity to make these touch cells feel like they're being touched at the ideal frequency to convey the right message to the brain to speak its own language.
Doctor,
it's non-invasive, right?
Right. Doctor, as far as a website, in case there's something that we did not touch upon or people want to follow more on it, do you have a website?
Yeah, my website is normandeutsch.com. normandeutsch.com, and my name Deutsch is like Dodge with an I, D-O-I-D-G-E. But, if you put in Norman and the brain's way of healing, you're going to get to that website pretty soon.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. We enjoyed it very much. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Norman Deutsch. He is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Brain That Changes Itself. The new book is The Brain's Way of Healing.
This is Primetime Postscript. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Some retirees from the United States aiming to make their savings stretch further head to a country with a lower cost of living. One popular destination is Buenos Aires, known by some as the Paris of South America, for its European-style architecture, its cafe culture, and its theater and nightlife. Eilish O'Neill caught up with two women from the States who moved south after retiring.
Sherry Magnus used to work as a librarian and a professional belly dancer in Los Angeles. She first came to Buenos Aires in 1997.
I was here for 10 days, and all I did was dance tango. There's a reason that people are drawn, who used to dance belly dancing or who do dance belly dancing, are drawn to tango, because it's improvised.
In 2002, when she was only 59 years old, Magnus had to retire from her job at the Los Angeles Public Library.
I had cancer two times, and I had chemo and radiation and all that, and I couldn't run around on my feet 40 hours a week anymore. I was just exhausted. So I had to take early retirement, which was hardly any money at all. It was such a little bit of money, I couldn't live in my own country anymore.
Magnus initially moved to San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, where she was only a 2.5-hour plane trip from her old life. While she was there, she took up flamenco dancing.
I missed the tango, and there was no tango in San Miguel, so I took the bus for 4 hours down to Mexico City to go to the milongas down there. And it was very expensive to do that, and it was a little scary all by myself. And I didn't even really like the tango that much that I found in Mexico City. So I said, what am I doing? I might as well just complete this journey.
So in early 2003, Magnus moved to Buenos Aires. At a milonga, a social tango dance, she met Ruben Aybar. They fell in love, and today, Magnus and Aybar give tango classes to foreigners. It's not a lot of money, especially not with inflation at 20 or 25% a year, but they get by. Across town in posh middle-class Palermo, another U.S. retiree in Buenos Aires, Arlene Kelly, drinks a white Americano and eats toast with cream cheese in her favorite cafe. She says her son talked her into coming to Argentina.
He would call me on the phone and say, Mom, you ought to think about moving down here because you could live so well here. And I thought maybe he'd lost his mind. I mean, why would I ever leave the United States?
In 2003, Kelly visited Chile, and from there, she and her son crossed the border to Bariloche, a town nestled in the Argentine Andes that caters to hikers in the summer and skiers in the winter.
And anybody would fall in love with Argentina if the first thing they saw was Bariloche. It's absolutely beautiful.
5 years later, in 2008, Kelly moved to Buenos Aires. She and dancer Sherry Magnus agree that daily life here has its ups and downs.
When I get on the subway, somebody will jump up and offer me their seat. Always.
Despite all the talk, I think that we're much more polite in the United States. Much more polite. When I go to LA and I see how the pedestrian steps off a curb, everybody screeches their brakes. Here, the bus drivers try and kill you if you're walking on the street.
If you go to pay a bill, you have to take a number and sit down and wait. If you want to talk to somebody at the internet place, you take a number and you sit down and you wait. They don't respect time.
The hardest part of being in Argentina, says dancer Sherry Magnus, is being so far from her two sons, who both still live in California.
Yeah, that part's really, really hard. And now my youngest son's girlfriend is pregnant. They're really happy. They're going to get married. They're looking for a bigger apartment. They're going to, you know, and I wish I could be there for all that.
But though being far from home can be hard, both Arlene Kelly and Sherry Magnus have reasons for staying here.
There's trees along the sidewalks. It's just a beautiful city. I like the fact that I can cross the street in anywhere I want to and nobody will give me a ticket. I like the feeling of being free.
What I love about living here, I love Ruben. I love the apartment. I love that there's a terrace. We had a barbecue on Tuesday. I've got plants. It's quiet. And I love the tango.
For Primetime Radio, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
This is Primetime Postscript made possible by AARP, and today, Alicia O'Neill. To hear more postscripts, please visit aarp.org/radio.
You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.